for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The siege of the U.S. Embassy at NATO headquarters in Afghanistan is over. Afghan and NATO special forces killed the last of the small group of Taliban attackers this morning. We'll talk about the attacks and what they mean in the context of America's decade-long war in Afghanistan. Joining me in the studio, Lawrence Korb. He's with the Center for American Progress. James Kitfield of National Journal magazine, and Ambassador Ronald Newman of the American Academy of Diplomacy. Before we begin our conversation, joining us by phone from Kabul is Quill Lawrence. He's NPR bureau chief in the Afghan capital. Good morning to you, Quill.
Good morning, Diane.
Glad to have you with us. Tell me how the militants went undetected before the attacks.
We don't know exactly. Some of the police we spoke to at the scene this morning claimed that they had entered the building wearing burqas. That's a claim that the police often make, and I haven't actually seen any of these burqas they said they found at the scene. It might just be something they say to try and humiliate the insurgents or insult the Taliban. But it was a complex effort. It could have gone on over days or weeks, the stashing of ammunition near this building. It couldn't have been easy with all of the checkpoints around this part of town, this being the most fortified part of town with many embassies, NATO headquarters, many Afghan buildings, Afghan government buildings, and, of course, the large U.S. embassy compound.
Do you believe that the attack had anything to do with the 9/11 anniversary?
It doesn't appear to have been directly related to the 9/11 date. The Taliban, when they were claiming responsibility, said that this was to refute some comments that had been made by the commander of U.S. forces here, General John Allen, in remarks that he did make on 9/11 about the Taliban having been weakened. But they didn't cite this as a 9/11 anniversary attack. It's a series. It's one in a series of attacks they've made in Kabul, three in the last 3 months, where they go for a maximum media exposure. They hit high-level targets, and the number of casualties hasn't been very high, but they've been hitting targets that people thought were safe, and that has really made an impression on people here in the city.
The U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, spoke today about the attacks. What did he have to say?
Well, Crocker downplayed the attacks. He said that this was harassing fire. He said if this was the best the insurgents could do, he wasn't worried, and mentioned how in Baghdad he faced this sort of thing all the time, where the embassy in Baghdad would get mortared when he was the ambassador there. And he also said that he thought that it was probably the Haqqani group, which is based in Pakistan, right across the border from host province in Afghanistan. And in mentioning the Haqqani group, he was directly linking essentially Pakistan to this attack. He also mentioned that it's very difficult to defeat an insurgency in Afghanistan when it still has safe havens inside Afghanistan.
But the question remains, would the attackers have had help from inside the Afghan security forces?
It's a possibility. Many people mentioned that to me talking to people in the streets during and after the attack. They said they thought there must have been sympathizers to the Taliban or people who had anti-American feeling. But it also points towards the level of competence of Afghan authorities and whether they're able to detect people, whether they are able to get tips. They've many times been able to pick up on conversations by phone. We can probably assume that they already have the phone conversations that were going on between Pakistan commanders in Pakistan and the fighters here on the ground, but they haven't been able to prevent many of these. They were, however, able to stop one of the suicide attackers yesterday before he could detonate his bomb.
James Kitfield of National Journal has a question for you.
I'm curious, does he have any evidence that this was actually the Haqqani network? Because I haven't seen anything in the news reports. I'm just curious if he's, or it's just an assumption that, that because they're so sophisticated, it's the Haqqanis.
The ambassador made a statement early today that he thought it was probably Haqqani, but no, he hasn't presented any evidence. I think that just because so many times this seems to be franchised out to the Haqqani network to find the suicide bombers and get them into town, as they did with the attack in June on the Intercontinental Hotel. But no, we haven't seen any evidence displayed. We may eventually hear the audio tapes of phone conversations as we have in past attacks.
And Lawrence Korp has a question.
Do you think that the Haqqani network or whoever did this thinks this is kind of a replay of the Tet Offensive? Well, regardless of whether it succeeded, psychologically it tells people in the United States and other NATO countries that things are not going well and it's time to change your policy?
It's interesting to make a Vietnam reference. Ambassador Crocker also said that and specifically said this is not a Tet offensive. Sometimes if you talk to some of the generals here who spent time in Iraq, or indeed Ambassador Crocker who spent time there, and they say, well, remember Baghdad, you'd have spectacular attacks like this every day or a couple of times a week, and here they're managing to do them once a month. That really doesn't do much to reassure Afghans around the country who feel that their security has gotten worse. And indeed, the United Nations estimates that there are more civilian casualties, most of them caused by the Taliban and other insurgents, but a higher number of civilian casualties than ever before in this conflict. So even if the numbers aren't as big or it's not as widespread as the Tet Offensive, there is definitely a feeling among the Afghan public that the insurgents are not getting weaker because they keep on staging these high-profile attacks.
And the Ambassador Ronald Newman.
Thank you. I had heard that there were three attacks yesterday, one on an ANCOP major headquarters, one on a district police headquarters, and the one in the hotel, and the two of the three were prevented by Afghan forces or failed to penetrate the wall. Is that your information?
I have information that they stopped one man with a vest near the airport. They prevented that attack, and that there were two successful suicide bombings in the west part of Kabul. Of course, you know this city very well, so I could tell you it's near Habiba High School in the west and near the Ministry of Traffic. And then there were six attackers. They had thought it was seven, but it turned out there were six indeed. I saw six dead bodies in the building near Abdul Haq Circle this morning.
So, Quill, are things back to normal today, if normal is a word that can be used?
No, I would say not quite yet. It was an attack that really shook Kabul. It was a safe area of the city. And just because these rockets, which were aimed at, I suppose, what the Taliban would consider a legitimate target, which is NATO headquarters and the U.S. embassy, but these RPGs were flying very wild of the target because they were firing, I suppose, from a 10-story building, and a slight problem with the aim meant that the RPG or the rocket ended up landing sometimes almost a mile off target. I was very close to an RPG that hit the back of a school bus, and that was probably a quarter mile away from the U.S. embassy, and it frightened people. An entire section of the city was on lockdown because they just didn't know where the next loose bullet was going to fly. All of these apartment buildings, people staying in their basements for almost 24 hours.
Quill, I know that Morning Edition's Renee Montaigne is also there with you in Afghanistan. Considering this latest attack, how do you and she manage to stay safe?
Well, luckily, Kabul is not really the front line in this war. We're not yet on lockdown conditions. We're still moving freely about the city as long as we keep a low profile. But I'd have to say, in its nearly 10 years of covering this conflict, I've never had such limited mobility. Early on, we were able to drive freely in a private car from here to Kandahar, from here to Mazar-e-Sharif, from here to Badakhshan. And now, although the roads have much improved over the years and so many other things have been built, it's unsafe. We can't drive 4 out of 5 major routes out of Kabul. And this is something that Afghans will mention all the time, that they feel less safe, particularly in the past 3 or 4 years, than they have in the past.
Now, we've had word that the top commander for NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan says the Kabul attack has left 27 dead, including Afghan police, civilians, and insurgents. U.S. Marine Corps General John Allen says of those killed, 11 were Afghan civilians, with more than half of them children. Allen says 5 Afghan police officers were also killed. So, Quill Lawrence, all we can do is hope and pray that not only this war comes to an end soon, but that you and all your colleagues stay safe. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Diane.
Thank you. Short break, and we'll be right back. And we're back now talking about the latest in Afghanistan, the attack on the U.S. Embassy and NATO headquarters in Kabul yesterday. While those involved have been killed themselves and they are considered to have been Taliban attackers, as you've just heard from Quill Lawrence reporting in Afghanistan and from Kabul, the streets are not safe. Here in the studio, Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. James Kitfield is senior correspondent for National Journal. Ambassador Ronald Newman is president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. He was U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the book titled The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. If you'd like to join us, I look forward to hearing your phone calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Ambassador Newman, what do you think yesterday's attacks say about the readiness of Afghan forces to take over?
I think you're seeing both progress and problems. And I think we should be careful that the analysis is a little bit balanced. My understanding from ISAF headquarters this morning was that there were three attacks. They failed. The other two did detonate, but they failed to penetrate security. A number of these attacks have. The Afghan security forces were largely in the lead in dealing with this and did deal with it. That's a big improvement from, say, May of 06 when they melted down during the riots. On the other hand, you obviously have a problem. You've got two sets of problems. One is preventing people getting in. That is enormously difficult when you're talking about very small numbers of people in a country where everybody owns arms. This is really hard to do. Second problem, obviously, is how did they get into a site that had this kind of ability to fire on the embassy and NATO? So you have holes, you have things that have to be plugged, you have an alarm with people, but I think you can also exaggerate those things a great deal and get into the sky is falling mode too easily.
James Kitfield, talk about the administration's current plans for withdrawal and maintenance.
Well, and it probably has something to bear on this instance. What this tells us, I think, that some things we already knew, which was that certainly the Haqqani network is not defeated. We keep, you know, the commanders in our regional command east on the border with Pakistan, where they have sanctuary, have said that time and again. This was almost certainly one of their operations because they're the most sophisticated of all the sort of subgroups under the Taliban umbrella. And the Taliban are very savvy propagandists, and they know that this is a critical time for us. We're trying to get reconciliation talks going. They understand that we are trying, the U.S. and NATO forces are trying to hammer them and the Taliban relentlessly to build leverage for those talks. They are using these sort of, really to me, a propaganda coup to say, you know, we are still here and we have some leverage in these talks as well. So, and we know that there's a period now, the surge troops that we put into Afghanistan last year will be out by next summer. So our ability to sort of – our maximum ability to affect the situation on the ground is this period right here. And they're trying to sort of say in this period right here, even though this is your maximum time to sort of counter us, we are still here and you need to negotiate with us.
James Kitfield of National Journal. Larry Korb, do you think that the attacks yesterday and the continued presence of the Taliban could in fact – change any plans the U.S. has about its timetable for withdrawal, also the economic situation here at home?
No, I don't think they will. I mean, President Obama was I don't think they will. President Obama was very clear when he sent the troops in that he would begin taking them out, and he has followed that because he does not want to repeat a Vietnam type of thing where you keep sending more and more troops and hoping for the best. I think that you also have a situation where in this country, time and time again, even strong national security people are saying, why are you spending $2 billion a week in Afghanistan when you've got problems here at home? And I thought what was remarkable in the debate the other night among the Republican candidates, they basically are saying, you know, let's accelerate, let's get out. Remember that the our NATO partners, and we have 40,000 NATO troops, they're also under pressure to get out. So I agree with James. Now is our maximum time to negotiate, and I hope that we are doing it and recognize that the longer we stay, the less bargaining leverage we're going to have. I mean, the longer this goes on. So now is the maximum time. Now I think you need to do it. And the Taliban, as James pointed out, they're very sophisticated. They recognize that, you know, maybe this wasn't a military victory. But, you know, the Tet Offensive was not a military victory, okay, when you look at it later on. But nonetheless, psychologically, it sent a message. We're here. You're going to have to deal with us. And I think even the Afghan people are saying, you can't protect us the way that we thought, so we're anxious to cut some sort of deal here.
Here's an email from Jonathan who says, I've not heard a single expert go on the record with discussions of true progress in Afghanistan. Neither has anyone predicted hope for success after U.S. military withdrawal. Why do we continue to waste American lives and money on a geographical area of loosely connected tribal warlords. The Karzai government barely rules Kabul, has little influence across the rest of the country. Ambassador Newman.
Yeah, I'd love to pick up on a few of those points. First of all, I don't think it is true that there... I'm quite sure it is true that there is, or false, that there's no progress. I think it's more complicated than most people understand. You clearly have had progress in parts of Helmand, which were full of fighting in the news last year. But it doesn't tell you much. You've had progress in securing the road corridor from the Pakistani border in Jalalabad up to Kabul. But the question now is, can you turn those over to Afghan forces? So it's false to say there's no progress. It's also not correct to say this is like you've gone from here to Baltimore and you're on the way to New York. It isn't that kind of a road. You're going to have to turn it over to the Afghans to prove it. Secondly, I don't agree that it is of little consequence. I think that what will happen if we go too quickly or with no solution is a civil war, the increase of extremism in Pakistan, which has 150 or 60 million people and nuclear weapons. I mean, there are some really dire issues we have to deal with. This is not a bumper sticker kind of discussion. And it's kind of amusing to watch our political debate, which is a little like kids' soccer, where everybody runs to one ball, which seems to be the budget debate now. I agree with Larry. We should negotiate. I think we have to understand that is not quick. There's a long history of other wars. Pick your Namibia, Cambodia. They all took years. We're in a process now of talking about talking. And there's a lot of posturing for position. And the only thing you can do by trying to... We should talk. I'm totally in favor of that. The only thing you can accomplish by trying to rush is to have a worse deal.
James.
for your listener, I'll go on record and say there has been progress. I mean, I was there in 2008 and reporting how it was backsliding. So I have to, having seen it in the last couple of years, say without question there's been progress. They have really wrenched the grip of the Taliban out of its traditional strongholds in Helmand and Kandahar. We have Afghan forces and U.S. forces down there, and those are functioning much more like normal places now. They have increase the size of the Afghan security forces by 110,000. They will be up to 305,000 by next month.
But do they operate?
They do operate, actually. I mean, they are working side by side with U.S. forces. They're now in tandem on most operations in Regional Command East and South. They are, by all measures, they have literacy training now for these guys. So they really have established something like what they did with the Iraqi security forces, which is meticulous training system that is now run mostly by Afghans. So this means it could be sustainable. So the bright light on the horizon here is a really credible Afghan security force is being stood up now. There are problems, but that progress is undeniable. I mean, because there's data behind it.
Well, certainly we're better off than we were. We tripled the number of troops. There's no doubt about that. But the real question is, as you pointed out earlier, more Afghans are dying, and that's what they're concerned about. Yes, the Taliban are doing it. If you made all this progress, how come they're still dying? And again, the Taliban don't have to win. They just have to not lose. And I think that's the key thing. And that's why, like it or not, we're leaving as well as our European partners. And so therefore, with the ambassadors, we should start negotiating and start now and recognize neither side can win.
All right. We've got callers. Let's open the phones first to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hey. I just wanted to reinforce the parallel with the Tet Offensive. You know, it's the war is not currently in our urgent national interest, so there's only a certain price that we're willing to pay to stay there. It's not going to go down to a war of attrition, last man standing type situation. It's going to be more of a war that we're not willing to fight anymore, and I think the Taliban understands that all they've got to show is they have more strength than we're willing to fight to actually win the war. We're not, you know, they don't stand or die the last man. And I think that war was lost when we pulled out and went to Iraq. And all they got to do is just show that they are not gone, and it's going to cost us more than we're willing to pay. And
all right, sir.
Win or lose.
Thank you. Larry Korb.
Well, I think the caller makes a great point. We let the opportunity slip away when we decided to divert our attention to Iraq, and now we're paying the price for that. Having killed bin Laden basically that takes away, I think, a very important reasons for us going there in the first place. Yesterday, General Petraeus and Michael Vickers, the Undersecretary for Intelligence, were speaking, and they basically said Al-Qaeda is just, about finished. So I think that's the reason. Now, what we need to do is to have an Afghanistan that's stable, doesn't threaten its neighbors. I mean, that's our goal. This idea you're going to have a democratic, Afghanistan is well beyond our capabilities.
But after 10 years of war, James Kitfield, are the Afghan people ready to accept, for the sake of peace, the Taliban?
They are not willing to accept the Taliban come back and rule them. They've had a taste of that, and it was not very pretty. We kind of forget how really onerous they were when they ran this country. They were really, 7th century fundamentalist, wouldn't let girls go to school, cut people's heads off in market squares, for stealing fruit, things like this. But they are tired of war. We're tired of war. I'd like to say that the question now is not whether we'll be standing there with the last man. We'll be out mostly by 2014. The question is, will we leave an Afghan security force that'll stand, that'll be able to take on the Taliban? I think there's a fair chance that could happen. And I disagree with Larry on this Tet Offensive analogy, because the Tet Offensive with tens of thousands of insurgents who took over the city of Hue, who, attacked the U.S. embassy, really fought for a number of weeks to a standstill forces. This is maybe 20 insurgents who, on a pretty meticulous operation, were able to scare people.
James Kitfield of National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Ambassador Newman.
Thanks. I very much agree with James. The Tet analogy ought to be put aside. It was a much more complicated operation, much more successful. And if this is a Tet, that's a failure of the media to distinguish the difference. But I would say there are a couple of things on this negotiation. Yes, we are going to go out, although we're going out at a measured pace. But it's not just the Taliban who can wait. The big question, the one you raised earlier, the Afghan army. If the Afghan army continues to improve, as it is improving, then you leave an Afghan force which also is not going to lose. So it's not only the Taliban who can just wait us out. The quality of the Afghan army, plus or minus, has yet to be determined. But that's going to be a significant variable in how people approach negotiations.
Well, what about creating the institutions necessary to keep that country stable? Can you really do that by virtue of the however number of military, Afghan military, you have in place?
You can help make a difference. There are a number of institutions. You have to start by remembering that this was a country totally destroyed 10 years ago. 25 years of warfare, no infrastructure. I first visited Afghanistan in 1967. They didn't have a whole lot then. And that was not only the physical destruction, it was the destruction of the education system, a generation that did not go to school, everything. So it was an intellectual destruction as well as a physical one. I mean, when you compare, people like to talk about a Marshall Plan, there was more infrastructure and more governance structure in Europe the day the bombs stopped falling than there was is still in Kabul after 10 years. There's a huge difference. There is a lot of progress, a lot of which is not adequate. We often have a definition, if it's not perfect, it's failure, which is a little bit silly. There is a lot of governmental problem in Kabul. We have also intensified the governmental problem, frankly, by very poor policies, which went a long way to convince President Karzai that we were deliberately trying to undermine him. This pushed him back on his political supporters, the very people we'd like him to fire, and created what you might call a political isometric. That's an exercise where you push really hard against yourself, get really tired, and go nowhere. And so I think some of the institutional problems are of our own creation.
Larry Kaur.
Well, they certainly are. But, Americans don't want to fight and die for President Karzai. I mean, basically, he's not the type of leader around which you can build. The key thing is his term ends in 2014, and I hope that we're preparing now to ensure that you have an election to get someone in there who has the support of the people. And remember, again, I don't want to push these analogies. They have killed members of Karzai's family, so these other side is recognizing that.
I don't know a single Afghan who believes the assassination of Ahmad Wali Karzai was carried out by the Taliban.
Well, if it wasn't, then if you can't protect the mayor there, who was the enemy then?
Family problem.
then Americans are fighting and dying for that? No, that's the problem.
Larry Corbes, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, now at the Center for American Progress. We'll take a short break, and we've got lots of email, phone calls, your tweets, and your Facebook postings. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Decades of corruption and a devastating earthquake have left Haiti in ruins. The UNESCO Special Envoy to Haiti on the country's efforts to rise up from its troubled past. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're talking about the ongoing war in Afghanistan. Many questions from you, including to you, Larry. What did the International Task Force on Negotiating Peace conclude?
Well, basically, they concluded that you need to start, as the ambassador said, you need to have a special representative. I would suggest, when I was there, I suggested, you know, that we have somebody from Turkey, for example, a Muslim country, member of NATO, take the lead. Now, we've been told that the Taliban have set up an office in Qatar, and I agree with the ambassador, we got to start, the sooner the better, and recognize that neither side can win. And I think that's the key thing. The one leverage we have, even though we're leaving, we'll be out by 2014, we will still can keep some forces because we're making a strategic agreement. And I think the Taliban demand, they want us out completely. So we can say we may be lighter, but we'll be there later unless you negotiate.
Ambassador Newman, do we have a special negotiator with the Taliban?
We don't even have much of a talk with the Taliban yet. I think Mark Grossman, our special representative who took Richard Holbrooke's place, is the one who's pretty much got this portfolio. But at this point, there is a lot of maneuvering, with the Taliban in particular trying to see if they can get a price for the benefit of talking to us. We were trying to do that previously. We've backed off that. We have no conditions for starting talking. We've laid out conditions that we think have to be observed in a conclusion. Taliban are still trying to get paid for the privilege of talking to them to begin with. That's basically a poor deal, but it's a normal phase that you go through where people try to see how far they can back the other side down before they start negotiating.
James.
Well, I mean, in terms of who's negotiating, we have, as our ambassador to Afghanistan and Ryan Crocker, the preeminent diplomatic troubleshooter of his generation. So we have a very able negotiator. Obviously, the Afghans will have to lead the talks because it's really between them and the Taliban, and with us and the Pakistanis on the sidelines, you know.
But what about Karzai? Is he holding his own talks with the Taliban?
Karzai has reached out for quite a long time and said he's willing to talk. We were flying, if you'll remember, some Taliban to Kabul and to facilitate those talks. One of those turned out to be not even have the current ties to the Taliban, but two things have happened in the last month that give me ideas that behind the scenes there was movement, one of which is there are reports now that Taliban are opening up a diplomatic presence in Qatar, and that's outside the realm of Pakistan, which is something that we approve of because we think Pakistan's being unhelpful in these talks. And we were fine with that. So it gives me an idea that those talks will be probably held in the Middle East in Qatar, and there'll be there's a formal sort of diplomatic presence there for the Taliban, first time that's ever happened. And you had this message from Mullah Omar for the first time since he was deposed in 2001, saying there have been talks with the Americans, and it sounded like he was willing to maybe come to the table.
All right, let's open the phones first to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Rudy.
Hello, Diane. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I'm a big fan of the show. I just have a quick statement and a question about the Afghan security forces, how they're going to be sustained after we leave. From what I know, Afghanistan has a lot of mineral resources, but it's been very difficult to access them. And so what sort of revenues does the Afghan state have to pay for the future addition of security forces or maintaining them? Will the U.S. have to foot the bill on that? And just a quick question. Thank you.
All right. Larry.
Well, I think the international community and the neighboring states should help foot the bill because they're threatened. India, for example, China, they don't want an unstable Afghanistan.
But will they?
Well, I mean, I think this is where the United States has to make it clear. It's not only us that are affected. Our main thing is we don't want Al-Qaeda to come back. And I'm certain with special forces and drones, we can make that keep that from happening. But the other countries in the region have an interest. They want a pipeline across Afghanistan. So basically, them or go through international institutions have to step up because given our economic situation, we can't be the only ones.
Does that answer it, Rudy?
Yeah, but from what I understand, it has very limited resources. And so will the international community have to constantly prop up Afghanistan?
Ambassador Newman.
There's quite a bit of potential, although there's question marks. We know that there are two or three times the amount of structures that could have gas and oil that were known previously. There is a gold mine, which is being bid on now. The Chinese just a couple of years ago won a $3 billion bid for copper in Afghanistan. There's a very large iron deposit, variety of other minerals. Now, none of those are a silver bullet because you've got to get the legal structure in place. You have to bid them. You have to get foreign companies in. But the totality of that suggests a lot of potential for Afghanistan down the road.
James.
It takes dimes, pennies on the dollar to support the Afghan forces versus having our own forces there. I think for the foreseeable future, we'll be happy to pull out if we leave in place a security force that can keep stability in that country. We have a lot of rich friends in the Middle East who also have ties to Afghanistan who we can tap, the Saudis being the primary ones. So I think we'll be happy to help them pay for those security forces until this whole civil war with the Taliban is basically figured out.
If, in fact, talks with the Taliban do occur, and they are successful, and we go back to some state of normalcy, what about the rights of women? Where will they be, Larry Korb?
It's interesting you mention that, because when I was part of this task force, it was run by Lakhdar Brahimi and Tom Pickering, we met with the former Mullah Omar's number two, who was put in prison in Bagram and got out. And we talked about this, you know, what will you do? And he said something to us that basically he said, we won't be any worse for women than Saudi Arabia. And of course, you know, we
Saudi Arabian women, you know, can't even drive, for heaven's sake.
I agree. And one of our other members was a former Turkish foreign minister, said, no, you got to be like Turkey. You know, a Muslim country that. And I think that's a key issue. But at least he didn't go say we want to go back to the old days like, you know, it used to be.
Diane, this is one of these issues where you can have it fast or you can get the kind of things you want. The faster you want to run after negotiations, the more you will give away things like the status of women, because you're paying the price to the Taliban in order for them to stop fighting. To have the kind of agreement that I think you're talking about, that is one of the reasons you take more time. And Foreign Minister Rabin, the late Prime Minister of Israel, said once that he had to negotiate as though there were no fighting and to fight as though there were no negotiations. He understood that these were parallel tracks. They were not alternatives. We have to understand the same thing.
Larry?
Well, I agree, and I don't know how long they'll take, and I think what we have in our back pocket is we're not going to be out completely. We'll be maybe down to 10,000 by 2014, but we'll still be there, and the Taliban doesn't want us to stay at all. They want us out completely, so that's the negotiating card that that we have. And, you know, it's interesting, we're talking about the Haqqani network and then Mullah Omar. The Haqqani network, when I was in government, we empowered them to fight the Soviets.
I know. Sad thought. Let's go to Cunningham, Kentucky. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. I just, the biggest question that comes to my mind when I think about both Afghanistan and Iraq, for that matter, is what's really the point? We are trying to overthrow the Taliban. We're trying to help overthrow Al-Qaeda. We're going after all of these terrorist groups. And we don't even have our own society in order. We don't have our own house in order. Yet we're sending our young men and women to two countries that have shown for decades and decades and decades that they're not interested in democracy. They're not interested in changing the ways that their governments function. And I'm raising my son by myself as a single father, and you know, I'm looking at discouraging him from going into the military in the future because I don't want him to die for Karzai's family. I don't want him to die for Karzai's corrupt government. If he's going to fight for America, then why don't we come back, pull out? If they collapse, they collapse. Another one will take over. Why are we so worried about these small cells and groups that we really honestly have no business messing with to begin with?
Passion from Jeremy.
Well, let me make a couple of points. He's right, I think, in terms of what we did. But remember, it wasn't just the administration. Congress voted for these wars. The mistake that they made is not paying for them. These are the first wars we've ever gone into significant where we not only haven't raised taxes, we cut them. And the other thing is we should have acted the selective service system rather than straining the men and women. And that would have got Americans to, you know, focus as he has. And I think the final thing is from now on, we're not going to do this again. We're going to use counterterrorism, not counterinsurgency and nation building. When you go after the terrorists, like we went into Pakistan and got bin Laden, we didn't try and occupy Pakistan. We got out of there.
So, James Kitfield, Jeremy is talking about fighting for Karzai's family instead of fighting for this country and what it needs. How big of a factor do you believe Afghanistan will be in the next election?
I actually don't think it will be a big factor, which says a lot about how war-weary this country is. We talked about the Obama administration is set. We're transferring the lead to the Afghans in 2014. We're pulling the surge.
But that's still 2 years, 3 years away.
That is a pretty near horizon as these things go. These wars take decades sometimes, and if you want to get involved in them, you either have the will to keep them, see it through, or you don't.
And clearly, we don't. At this point, we don't.
So my, I keep making the point. We can see the end of this thing. We know how it's going to end. There's no political movement in this country that's going to say, no, stick to Afghanistan for longer than 2014. So we know what the timeline is. We know what the withdrawal slope. And all I will say is, you know, in a shorthand, how he got into this. I mean, Jeremy expressed the war weariness of this country very well. And I get that. We're all weary of these wars. You know, I think if you go back to 2001, we all understood Afghanistan, though. We were 3,000 Americans died on 9/11. We just, you know, celebrated the 10th anniversary. Those images are back in everyone's mind. The Taliban ruled Afghanistan. We're friendly to al-Qaeda. We had to go in there. And we had this tradition of we go in a place and invade it. We try to leave it better than when we came in. And that has cost us dearly. If we want to just go in there and topple governments and leave and let what fall we may, we can do that. But that's also what led to 9/11, if you recall.
All right. Let's go and hear from another perspective, Jim in Clifton, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Glad to have you with us, sir.
As a retired military officer, I try to follow security issues in the region, and I recently read an essay where the author was arguing for a continuing presence in Afghanistan, in part to have regional influence, particularly with Pakistan, which has more vital interests to U.S. national security policy. And I'd love to hear the panel's comment, and I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Newman.
I think Pakistan looks at Afghanistan through the lens of its fears of India. And that's, by the way, one of the problems. If we have a rapid pullout and a civil war, which we could have, I think Pakistan will move closer to extremists because the Indians will back their own friends. Our role in Afghanistan is partly, wasn't designed for this, but I think it has to be partly focused on bringing together a bit of a regional solution that's where everybody stops messing around. That's going to be hard to do. I also think that if we are leaving quickly, and there is a civil war, Pakistan's strategic interests will move toward helping extremists and away from helping us, that we will influence them severely.
Ambassador Ronald Newman, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, a caller in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Tim.
Hi there. Thank you. Just a quick kind of comment after listening to this. I keep thinking about the idea of what victory looks like anymore. And, you know, going all the way back to World War II, it was very obvious what victory looked like. There were people standing, you know, in a very grand manner, and it was very proper, and on a big boat, and they sat down and they signed documents together saying, we surrender and we win. And it was all clean and easy, and everyone moved forward. But, you know, practically every conflict that we've gone into since then, victory certainly doesn't look like that, if it's victorious at all. It's messy, it's very unclear, and really it only seems to make sense to those who are the experts and those who are the ones who make the decisions to put us in these conflicts. And so for me, what I look at going into the future is that it's going to be extremely difficult for those politicians, you know, the people in the military who make these decisions to sell the idea of America going into conflict to win, when what winning looks like is not clear at all, particularly when we're in an age of the 30-second soundbite.
Larry Korb.
You make a great point. When the last time I went to Baghdad, my grandson said, you got to buy a gift. I thought, oh, the last thing I want to do is go shopping. So I got a polo shirt for him, and I looked inside when I got home. It said, Made in Vietnam. Remember when people used to say, if you leave Vietnam, look, I think Jim is right. It's a messy place. You're not going to have complete victory. But we can't overestimate the damage that it can cause to us. Would I like Afghanistan to be a Central Asian Valhalla? Sure. But I don't think we have the wherewithal to make that happen. So we're going to have to accept a less than perfect solution like we did in Vietnam.
James.
I think he makes a great point. These kinds of wars, these insurgencies, don't have the sort of Battleship Missouri moment. They're very unsatisfying in a lot of ways. And I think we'll be very, very sober about doing this again for quite a long time.
Ambassador Newman.
I agree with everything that you both said. I also think that having watched every single administration since World War II involve itself in some form of intervention, including administrations like the Carter administration, we have to assume that it probably will happen no matter how bad an idea it may be.
You think it will happen again?
I'm absolutely convinced of it. And I think I think history tells you that it will happen, because every time we've made up our minds that we're not going to do it, we've ended up doing it again, whether it's a Grenada or Panama.
We don't learn from history.
Well, the other thing we don't learn is to preserve anything we have learned in the tactics, the capabilities. We could have done Afghanistan a great deal smarter at the beginning, not only because we went to Iraq, but also because we simply neglected the place for the 2 years before we went to Iraq. So it would be a good idea if we would at least learn a few lessons and hang on to them.
I fully agree. Ambassador Ronald Newman, he's president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal. Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.